The assumption had been that they could program the station without even looking to see who's out there listening in. And she had helped them. She had been a part of the feminist movement. She was a middle-class woman. So I asked her, can you prove your income? Because another charge was these were all capitalists. Well, if you're a multinational capitalist supporter, you generally have some income and personal assets to show it. Here's a woman in a middle-class neighborhood who I had a chance. She showed me, without any hesitation, her financial statements, whatever I want to see. Did I want to see her bank balances, her income tax statements? Everything was there for me to see. Hardly what you would expect from someone hiding anything. So what do you make of a middle-class senior citizen who had spent her life in the civil rights feminist movement, who, by the way, also worked herself through night school to get a PhD and had a modest business, her own home-based business, consulting and helping minority elements within businesses. Sounds like a pretty decent way to earn a modest living and to do something constructive for society and your race. But oh, look at those websites. Look at what was being said by the people who are absolutely right and fanning the flames. So when I spoke with Joel and some of the other demonstrators and who had trashed her house, trashed her car, death threats, no one had bothered to talk to her at all. Just the presumption of guilt. A little thing like facts and truth didn't seem to matter. I could just see Robespierrean people everywhere. So she fought, and I said, why are you on the board? I was put on the board by my local lab because they felt I could represent a reasoned voice of helping guide the foundation to a place where it wasn't in constant conflict with itself. So I took a look at the bylaws. I took a look at all the minutes of meetings. And I couldn't see where any effort had been made by any board member to bring up for sale the stations. And I interviewed these board members, and I looked at all the different board meetings. So I'm thinking, well, surely that's the heart of all this. You know, they took over the stations so they could sell them. Well, then that gets to this one memo. In point of fact, the truth is, the reality is, there was never an effort by Pacifica National Board members to sell the station. That is a fact that is irrefutable. But people who don't do their homework will tell you otherwise. What they do is they took a Michael Palmer, a member of the board, again from his local lab in Houston, who went to a meeting, and this was a five-year planning meeting, and there were hundreds of people at this planning meeting, and he was interviewing people as the new treasurer and asked him a wish list, and he said, what would you like to see in the future of Pacifica over the next 5 to 10 years? And people were telling, well, we'd like a better station, we'd like more pay, we'd like better transmitters, we'd like, you know, more engineers, we'd like a stronger signal, we'd like to upgrade our signal, we'd like to have an advertising budget, we'd like to have, you know, some, and all these people said what they wanted. So he went back home, and mind you, all these people serve as volunteers, none of them are paid, and he was doing his math, and it came up to where it was in the neighborhood of $9 to $12 million. Trouble is, Pacifica did not have that kind of money. And so he thought that one of the ways that you could get that kind of money, and he put this in a memo, which was not distributed to each of the board members, that what if they switched a signal? Now, switching a signal means this, that you take a station like BAI in New York that has a commercial station license, and you sell the signal, let's say for $100 million. You then buy another signal down the dial that's unused for $4 million. You upgrade the signal, And then you have all this money, and then you go to each of the stations and you give them what they need at each station. You don't go off the air. You don't change your programming. You just tell your audience in advance that as of this date, we're moving from 99.5 to 57.8. And that's called switching signals. That was what he had advocated. Now, what's of interest is this person who was at one time my friend had advocated that to me 10 years earlier when we were struggling to make ends meet at the station, and we were having a hard time of it. And he talked about this, and in fact, several people believed that a switching of a signal would have made sense. Economically, it would have. The idea would have been you'd have had enough money to have bought new stations in the Midwest, to have upgraded all the other stations, but that never happened. In fact, the people who were considered the progressives were attacked for having been believed that they had advocated this, and I reviewed every single meeting, every single board meeting's minutes. Not once was that ever brought up. In fact, they advocated not doing it. In fact, Frank Millspaugh, who at one time had been the station manager to BBBAI and was later on the board, gave me a whole history of the movement of the board and how the board had been fractionalized forever. There had always been people with opposing ideological, political, and even media agendas. And that more often than not, they did nothing. And the communication between the board and the stations was abysmal at best, and non-existent or antagonistic at worst. And certainly it had been my case. I never got a return letter, no matter what suggestion or comment or complaint I might have made. But that's not the same as saying someone has an intention to sell a station that personally profits. So I look for the smoking gun. Where is the evidence that someone's going to make a commission? Because that letter was going everywhere. It was all over the internet. And it was being heard at every single dissident meeting. You know, we've got to stop them from selling the stations. Well, I found there was no effort to sell the stations by the Pacifica board. One memo as a suggestion. Well, when does it become a crime to have a suggestion that is not implemented or acted upon or even taken up for consideration? But it's all you need. A little bit of truth. One man with a wish list to make it a better foundation and a better stations makes the mistake, and he said, Gary, quote, I will never make that mistake again of thinking that an idea could help people solve their problems when they use it like a dagger and stab me in the back with it. But again, is he a rich capitalist? I want to know. Can you show me your financials, your income tax statements? Yeah. Middle class, working in the local community, part of the progressive movement for a long time. Then we go to Ken Ford, another African-American, middle class. We're not talking about wealthy people. We're not talking about people making $100,000 or more per year. Most of these people made between $40,000 to $60,000. What most middle-class people, firefighters, people working, will bring home. Certainly most families have to bring that home if you've got two people working. And none of them had any evidence that they were trying to sell the stations. So the information being circulated and taken out of context and trying to put into a different context, what was like morphing, you know, Michael Jackson to look like Ben Affleck. You know, you might be able to get someone to believe it, but it's not going to be true. But then if it wasn't selling the stations and changing the bylaws, in fact, to the contrary, on these votes, it was frequently unanimous. Well, why didn't the other members of the board stand up and say, hey, these people are being attacked for the wrong reasons? We were at the same board meetings. You know, this wasn't an issue. What was really at the bottom of all this, and this is the hard part for anyone to accept, was that there was a difference in the ideology of what non-commercial radio should sound like. There was a difference between should it sound like more radical themes? Should it be more libertarian themes? Should we cater more towards a mainstream? And there was division within the local stations, in programming and management. There was a division in the national board. And it's difficult for people to appreciate that you really cannot have two diametrically opposite views of the direction that a media group should take if you want to have anything that represents unity or anything that represents cooperation. So if you have half a board that wants to go in one direction because it serves their political identity and the other half going in another direction, and it's not to say that one or the other is right or wrong. It's just that it's always been that way. So there's always been these fights going on. That's what I was able to determine. But it's kind of hard to get anyone all roused up if you say, well, we, the undersigned, we believe that people don't have to have standards or accountability. We believe that freedom of speech is absolute. If you want to get on the air and you want to curse or you want to attack people or you want to do some brilliant broadcasting, whatever you want to do, you have a right to do it. And no one can tell you otherwise. And we believe that a person wants to run a radio station, they can run it without any background or experience whatsoever. And they want to put all their own friends in positions of power so they can all get paid. That's okay, too. And there's another group. What if they said, well, we believe you're going to run a radio station, you should have a background in professional media and radio. You're going to be a program director. You should have a background. And if you're going to be on the air, you should be held accountable. And are you talking to someone other than yourself or a small, tiny clique of people? And this is what it came down to. But people didn't want to deal with this issue. They wanted to make it a conspiracy. Now, to the fact of the coup, hence the justification of the counter coup, here are the actual reality of this. Ms. Van Isler was asked over a period of 6 months to change the way that she was managing the station. This has been independently confirmed. She was asked this by her friend, who was her boss, the executive director, Bessie Wash. Bessie Wash was not happy with many of the things occurring at BAI in New York and gave her a list of things that she would have to change. These were not changed. And therefore, Bessie Wash told Valerie Van Isler that she would give her a promotion. Now, I've independently confirmed that this was actually what was offered, a $6,000 raise, a better job in that she could be an executive producer, commuting between New York and Washington and all of her expenses paid, produce whatever show she wanted, and that those would be shows that would be aired on the Pacific and different stations. Because Bessie felt that she was a very good journalist and a very ethical journalist, but was not the kind of management that she wanted to see in place. Valerie Van Isler refused this. Then finally, in the fall, Bessie met with Valerie and told her that she would have to take that or she'd be replaced. Now, here is the sequence. When the station manager, BAI New York, refused the job of a better job, better salary, less stress, less hassle, she then let others in the station know. There was a little clique, the Bernard White and Amy Goodman clique, Juan Gonzalez clique. They virtually ran the station's programming and they did what they wanted to do, for better or worse. Suddenly, in the beginning of December, on the air, you began to hear stories about, you know, taking over the station, the corporatization of the station. And this began to culminate. During this period of time, Juan Gonzalez, another WBAI, a person, was asked if they could become a station interim station manager. This person had been a long time, highly respected news reporter, and agreed to do so. But at a series of meetings and private confrontations, the clique was very unhappy with this guy becoming the station manager because he was a no-nonsense guy. You couldn't get away with anything with this guy. I mean, he had to kind of play straight, and he was objective, and he wasn't going to let any one group run it, and he was going to hold you to standards. They just dumped on him. And it was at a time when his father was sick and in the hospital and dying, and he was in the hospital, and so he just said, I don't need this. And he said no to Bessie Wash. Well, now we're up around the 20th of, or just before the 20th of December, and so she turns to one other person who she didn't know. In fact, they'd never met, and that was Utrice Lead, a long-time, highly respected person on the air at BAI and an activist. And she said, would you take over as interim station manager? And Utrice, who had been hearing all the rumors about the problems with the foundation, said, I would only under the following circumstances. There's no firings and bannings and all this stuff. And Bessie agreed to that. And I was given a memo to prove that. So here you had a Bessie Wash who did not know Bernard Utrice Lead. Utrice, who had been initially selected after a very comprehensive search for program director, but after a democratically done process to elect her, from all the candidates, Bernard White was given the job by Valerie Van Isler. And that's important to keep that in perspective, because the so-called democratic processes were not working when it came to who was going to be program director. Because she would have been. Now she was the station interim manager. Bessie Wash is hearing from her hotel room that the station's going to be taken over the next day. She can't believe her ears. It's been on the morning shows. They were telling people to meet at the station. And indeed, Utrice was kind of awash in all this going on because there were all kinds of people coming into the station, taking over people's offices, going onto people's personal computers, planning for this big takeover of the station. They were going to take over the airwaves, virtually capture the airwaves at BAI and broadcast their point of view 24 hours a day and keep off the airwaves the people they disagreed with, in effect a lockout of the people who where they considered the enemy. Bessie Wash is executive director of the whole Pacifica Foundation, a black woman, an activist coming from the civil rights movement. She knew something that evidently the people who were doing this didn't know, that the FCC board hated Pacifica and would like nothing better than to see it make a big mistake. One of the rules of the Federal Communications Commission is if you lose control of the air, you can lose your license. And she believed that it would have been the spark that would have caused the investigation that would have caused the station to have its license challenged or lost. So she ran over to the station that morning. They got there in late morning, early afternoon, and she met with Utrice and she said, what are we going to do? And Utrice says, well, we don't even have a lock on the door to keep these people out in the morning. At that point, Bessie says, what do you mean you don't have a lock on the door? She says, no, it was broken several years ago. Anybody can come in here, and they do. Strangers are coming in all the time and stealing stuff. And Bessie said, well, that's a security risk. I mean, nobody would allow their office to have a no lock on the door in New York City in this neighborhood. Well, it just never gets fixed. So they called a locksmith. Mind you, this is on Christmas week, just a couple days before Christmas, and they could find one locksmith who could do an emergency, put a lock on the door, but he could only do it in that early evening. So that early evening, the man came and he changed the lock. So at least there wouldn't be a flooding of all these strange people into people's offices and on the airwaves. So the next morning, these people showed up. They were not allowed in the station. And the people whose program it was in the morning show were suspended with cause. They would later say there was no cause, when in fact there was cause. I've independently verified all this, clear down to the locksmith. So now, what a different story it is. Were there purges, firings? Only Valerie Van Isler. And she was given a month to close up her office and by January 1st. If you're going to fire someone, do you generally give them a month to hang around? No. Most people are fired on a Friday evening at 5 o'clock and escorted out. You're not given a month. And you're not given 6 months' warning. And you're not given an opportunity for a better job and a pay raise. And there were no purges. There was no coup. Well, if there was no coup, and there was no effort to sell the station, then all that was untrue. Yeah, well, it doesn't make it look quite as interesting and provocative and desperate if that part of the story is told. A midnight coup, changing the locks in the middle of the night. No, there was no lock on the door. So they put a lock on the door to keep the airwaves from being taken over. Regular programming continued, but the people who've been advocating the takeover were those, the producer and the host of that show were dismissed. That started the events where people then began attacking people on the air. And it was a mess. Both sides began attacking. Those people who had been friends of Utrice were attacking the people who were choosing to be off the air, who never really had been on the air. I felt that it was unfortunate because once I began to observe all this, I wasn't going to take sides because I didn't see either side as being right in the tactics being used. I didn't see that Utrice Lead, who was overreacting, but she was being baited. And I know from meetings where people were setting her up of what they could say and what they could do to get her to react. And she bit every time. And this is what spread then nationally. Now, out of this came the movement of the labs. And that's a different story. For that story of what happened that went from a non-coup that we were all led to believe was this heroic, you know, effort to take back the stations when the stations were never at risk of being sold, from multinationalists who were not, but who had different ideas of standards. And I've seen people who've had standards fired. I saw someone in the position of management at the station 15 years ago who wanted to make people accountable for things that were said, for accuracy on the air, fired. I saw people who brought outstanding programming that some other people didn't like. There was a man who had Lex Hickson had a program on spirituality. And Lex was ganged up on, and he was let go. One of the best programs in the history of Pacifica, taken off the air, because there was a small clique that didn't want to hear it. So I'm used to this infighting. I'm used to seeing one group try to dominate another group for 3 or 5 or 6 or 8 years. But I'd never seen anything quite like making up a whole bunch of things. Now, does that mean that there were problems with the board? You bet there were problems. But not the kind of problems and not for the same motive we've been led to believe. You just had the wrong mix. Now, today, we have local labs that want to dictate station management. Then one of the best examples of this that I'm personally familiar with is PFW in Washington. PFW in Washington has people who are adamantly opposed to what should be on the air. And they believe they have a right to fire anyone from any show who broadcasts something they don't like and put something on they do. I've looked at the background and qualifications of these people, and they have none. They have no background in media. They have no background in what I would consider objective causes. And they mainly come from a very angry point of view that anything that reeks of success is something, or even represents success, to them reeks of needing to be dismantled. Well, where is it in the works and writings of Lou Hill that we should be engaged in this kind of conflict when the whole basis of Pacifica means pacifist. When Lew Hill dedicated his life to pacifism, and yet I have seen things that today would fall under the rubric of terrorism. I've seen people on the board who were gotten off the board by death threats, vandalism, computer hacking, lies to their employees and workers, harassments that most people could not tolerate. So when you take power, no one has reviewed how did you get the power. Did you get the power at the point of a gun? And that gun can be a verbal harassment. Doesn't have to be a physical gun, but guns actually have, you know, fires, shots have been fired. And no one is asking, well, gee, now that the dissidents are on power and they got rid of the people on the board they didn't like so they could have their agenda met, was it ethical? Did it honor Pacifica's mission? No, it did not. It wasn't ethical. I've been able to document numerous cases of illegalities. Well, my God, if you take power using illegal methods, then what separates you from the supposed people that you don't like? Because they weren't using, they weren't fighting back. That was what was unique. You go after some multinationalists, they're going to fight you. They're tough. They got deep pockets and frequently are ruthless. I've gone after multinationalists my whole career. These people were, with two exceptions, they were all African-American, middle class, socially conscious, but educated and professional standard people. Their vision was different. They wanted some standards. Not one of them fought back. Not one. They just kept getting hit and hit and hit and hit. And then finally, they could get hit no more, and they just withdrew. And so the victory cry went out. I'm ashamed at that victory, because at some point someone should have the decency and honesty to take a look at what you did to get where you're at. What methods did you use? And that hasn't been done yet. But there's also, that's only half the story. The second part is, now they feel they can do with the stations and with its management and through the labs whatever they want. So no longer should we ever again, from this moment forward, never use the word Pacifica, because it doesn't exist. Never mention Lew Hill's name that everyone invoked, because there's nothing that Lew Hill would agree with what's been done. If you want anarchistic radio, you've got it. If you want radical radio, you've got it. Whatever you want to call it, do so. But at least be honest about what you want and what you've created. The agenda is now coming full circle. That's what's interesting about sticking around long enough. You'll see the truth because it'll work itself through. And in the middle, you can't see it. You got to see it at the end. So now we're taking a look to see what we have actually had people create. Do we have a better network? Do we have better radio stations? Do we have better programming? Do we have more listeners getting better media because of what's happened? Or are we going to keep blaming people who we disagree with of how they manage? Well, I'm very much opposed to labs having any control over the programming of a station, because that was never a part of Pacifica's mission, ever. And yet now today the labs are the number one thing on everyone's agenda. And the labs in Washington, the head of that lab there, is voraciously attacking the station manager, again an African-American, and the program director, an African-American, business manager, African-American. Is it anything to do with race? Well, in time we will see. But I will tell you one thing, that when one person self-appoints themselves to dictate what a lab should be, and then says, this is what everyone should be listening to, and this is who should run a station, and here's how we want it done, then there's nothing democratic about that at all. There's nothing free speech about this at all. There's nothing progressive about it at all. And there's nothing serving the larger good of the people who are voiceless at all. And that's the direction we're in right now. So when I see that there is an enormous conflict occurring at KPFK, I have to ask, what lessons can we learn from previous conflicts, including the Pacifica conflict, that before people get too far bent out of shape on either side, that they stop and ask themselves, how could they approach this in a more peaceful, a more humane, nonviolent way, and then proceed from there? What you ultimately do is up to you. But I know what we've done at BAI, and everything you could do wrong was done wrong. Paul Dorenzo is on the phone now. Paul Dorenzo is a reporter, newscaster from WBI in New York until he was fired. He was one of the newly purged. And by the way, more people have been fired or purged since the takeover of the Leslie Kagan board than were fired or purged before. Paul, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks a lot, Gary. Good morning.
Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me? Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Great. Good morning, Gary. Very interesting presentation. Hello?
Paul, can you hear me, Paul?
Yes.
Okay, Paul, first, would you give, you've heard what I've said up to this point, and and it's taken me an hour and 40 minutes to say this, and this is only a little small part of the story, and I'm not, I don't want people for a moment to think that people from previous boards have not made lots of mistakes, but right now our biggest mistake is not understanding what's going on with the labs. Would you explain the labs in association with what they're trying to achieve, what's going on, and how that can impact upon people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's a lot about this, but I think in a lot of ways the rise to power of the labs, there's nothing. There's no precedent to this in Pacifica history. Local advisory boards were brought in by the United States government, by the FCC actually, and forced down Pacifica's throat back in the 1970s as part of a conservative move by the government to get more control. They wanted to get more control because they thought that the general listeners or the people who were potentially the audience would be a conservative factor on these radical programmers. And so they would force them to have to interact with their listeners and hopefully have a conservative sort of chilling effect on the actual producers of the time who were coming out of the 60s and 70s in an anti-war mentality, anti-government, pro-civil rights type of mentality. And so that's really the real history of the labs. I mean, the labs are basically the government's attempt to try and control Pacifica going back at least 30 years. That never really occurred because the labs never really had any power. And in fact, FCC regulations and law makes it clear that local advisory boards of radio stations cannot have any management powers. And in fact, in order to deal with that contradiction, the new bylaws have all kinds of proposals that will somehow create a new set of boards that will then have this management power that they're looking for to come from the listeners, quote unquote. And I assume they'll allow the labs to continue on as these appendages that the government requires that have no power by law cannot have any power. So in a sense, what the bylaws, the new bylaws, and what the new regime of Pacifica wants to do is create yet another level of control or power, which, it seems like it's just adding more bureaucracy on top of bureaucracy, and what is the purpose of this? Well, you know, the more I see what's going on, what I see is really the rise of and the conquest of Pacifica by a concept, an ideology. I wouldn't say it's a radical ideology, Gary. You know the word I would use? It's identity politics. And identity politics are sweeping our network and are sweeping every station. Not I think, as a movement of the listeners, but a movement of certain programmers who are very much involved in what we would call identity politics. And identity politics, in my mind, this idea of, like, you know, you're a certain movement, your group, black people as a group, gay people as a group, pink-toed hippopotamus from Canada as a group, whatever it might be, this fracturing of Pacific entities, little identity groups, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of most progressive people, represents a defeat. It represents a defeatist attitude that the ideals that Lou Hill and that Pacifica were created around uniting people and bringing people together, that the folks who are promoting these identity views have given up on this, that this will never happen, and that therefore all they can do is turn Pacifica into a base area to fight for the interests of their identity politics, their identity view, a very self-oriented view, a very me, I, myself type of view, as opposed to an us, our, everybody working together type of view, which is, I think, the direction that Pacifica was meant to go in and what progressive politics really means. So I'm very concerned about the rise of these identity politics, because, of course, that would mean that that the radio and the air would become yet more unlistenable as programs are reduced to speaking to extremely small subgroups of society. In a sense, we talked about the voice of the voiceless, and the people that seem so positive, I mean, Mumia Abu-Jamal, voice of the voiceless, but in actual fact, I don't see how WBAI or KPFK or any of these stations were ever meant to be the, quote, voice of the voiceless, unquote. What does that mean? Does that mean we give programs to everybody who's never been heard before? Do we give programs to every movement that's never had an opportunity to be heard? I mean, there's so many strange and bizarre views that seem so radical. I mean, should we give if this was back in the 1970s, would we give Patricia Hearst and that group that was Symbionese Liberation Army, do they get a show? Does the Weather Underground get a show? Does every subgroup, does the militias get a show? Do the left-wing militias get a show? Does every show that represents some group I can think of all, you know, I don't want to get into it, but I can think of all the subgroups within subgroups that could all say, well, we're voiceless. Nobody's ever heard us before. We deserve a show. And where does that take us? It takes us to, I think, a disastrous direction, and that is the direction that Pacifica is being dragged into right now. I think, you know, the labs are attempting to, or many of the members of the labs are attempting to really ensure that Pacifica goes in a certain political direction, because they represent, many of the members of these labs represent groups or organizations, or different small cliques of power that want to keep their power, and they want to use the labs and somehow use the bylaws process to ensure that that they are never or can never be removed from power, which is, I think, a very bad idea and a very bad direction to go into. There's, if you want to be the voice of the voiceless, where's the democracy in that? It's more of a tyranny of these small groups and of these grouplets and these organizations. And, you know, let me be even more specific, because, you know, I have no problems with anybody being involved in Pacifica, no matter what their organizational associations or their friends or their political associations. There should be space at Pacifica for anybody to do a program, as long as I think it's a good program, as long as at least the listeners think it's a good program. And, in fact, there's various different models that are at battle right now. We have the so-called KPFA model for how labs will be integrated into Pacifica and bylaws, and then you have the New York based the so-called Unity Caucus model. And I was looking at the KPFA model, and it's very interesting. And one of the points it makes out of many very interesting points is that no one should be allowed to have a position on the board of Pacifica if they are in any way part of a political office. A delegate shall be deemed, this is one who can become a member of the board or choose a member of the board, shall be deemed to have resigned the position of delegate if he or she becomes a candidate for public office or receives a political appointment during his or her term as a delegate. Well, that's very interesting because our current board director, Leslie Kagan, who I've known for many years, is, in fact, concurrently a leading member, one of the three or four co-directors of a political organization that is involved in all kinds of electoral and other politics called the Committees of Correspondence. And I find it interesting that we have a board of directors that's led by a person, Leslie Kagan, who is the head of the board of directors of another political organization at the exact same time. Personally, I think that Ms. Kagan should resign one of the two positions. She should either be in charge of the Committees of Correspondence or in charge of Pacifica. I don't think she can. I think there's a conflict of interest that she should be in charge of both groups at the same time. And that's not that, listen, I have many, I'm very closely associated with many people in the Committees of Correspondence, and I've done a lot of journalism to help people who are in the Committees of Correspondence who are dearly persecuted and unfairly persecuted by the federal government. My partner Joni Moosey and myself wrote for Penthouse Magazine about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, about a case where a leading member of the Committees of Correspondence in Washington, D.C. was persecuted by the FBI because of her political beliefs, persecuted in a most unfair way and driven in and into prison. And I wrote quite, we wrote quite extensively on that issue. So, I am supportive of, if not of every political view that the Committees of Correspondence makes, that they should have a right to freedom and to express their views and ideas. In that specific group, I have a history of defending their right to do that. However, I think it's incorrect for Leslie to be one of the three, along with Charlene Mitchell and some others, to be one of the three or four top people in that organization, the Committees of Correspondence, which is associated with the Greens Party very closely, and at the same time, be the director of Pacifica. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, is going wrong with in the last year at Pacifica that we have to face. It was very, you know, let's look at the contract that was signed with Amy Goodman. I mean, to me, that is, it was horrendous, and it was interesting that so many people who were so supportive of the Pacifica campaign, once that contract was signed, were shocked and so and didn't expect this to have happened and are now extremely doubtful about their support. I mean, I've talked to many who have...
Paul, a lot of people listening may not know what you're talking about. Could you give background on this?
Right.
I'm Gary Nall. My guest is Paul DiRienzo. Paul DiRienzo...
DiRienzo, by the way, Gary.
DiRienzo. Paul has been a person associated with Pacifica for 20 years and was on the news team and programming and was purged. And is in fact now in a national labor relations in a challenge to get his job back, and he was one of over 51 people who have been purged after these people took control. And just quickly a note, I look carefully at the three former heads over a period of approximately 12 years of the Pacifica board and some of their actions. And I find it extremely troubling that Leslie Kagan and Ann Coughlin can make some of the choices they're making today with virtually no opposition. Example, signing an agreement with Amy Goodman where they're not, by their own Pacifica bylaws, allowed to do such. Two, firing or interfering in the day-to-day operations of a station. No member of the board, Pacifica board, is allowed to fire, hire, or interfere in the day-to-day operations of any Pacifica station. That's been done. She personally fired and did so in a very humiliating way, in a degrading way, the station manager, Bob Daughtry, in New York, who, excuse me, had only been there for under a year. And
was very popular with the workers there. We finally got a decent union representation for the workers under Bob Daughtry. We were able to actually begin decent negotiations. You know, people don't realize it, but the day that Leslie came in and they fired Bob Daughtry, that the staff, the entire paid staff of WBAI was gathered in a room when he was fired in front of us, And, you know, he had been fired in public before that, but when he actually was given the papers. And the entire, quite spontaneously, the entire group of employees got up and gave him a standing ovation. He was the best manager we'd had, you know, in the history of that station.
Oh, absolutely. No station manager that I'm aware of had ever been as ethical, as decent, as calm, and as patient with people. And he also had standards. Yeah. There were some harebrains there who should never been on the radio, and that's something I don't think people appreciate.
He's always confronting people who, these nutty people who used violence and intimidation tactics to stay in power and to have shows, and he started confronting them and calling them out and wasn't afraid to, and didn't back down. He was the first one I ever saw who did that.
He believed that if you were on the air, you had a responsibility to maintain standards of ethics and honesty. And that's something has been grossly lacking in the management of many Pacifica stations or in programming. Not everybody deserves to be on the air. Not every show should be on the air. The idea that everybody who can get on the air deserves to be there and stay there, I don't feel is at all right. And that's why there's such terrible listenership to some programs. And it's unlistenable in some cases, but a lot of those people that were in the streets fighting to help the clique stay in power have been given nice jobs and paid jobs on the air.
It's unbelievable. The fighting that's going on now over the spoils, it sort of like reminds me, I want to see the movie Gangs of New York. It's being replayed at WBAI.
Well, we had one person who I spoke with. He's never been on radio, never belonged to any progressive movement, just happened to be in part of the demonstrations, a very angry demonstrator, and now he thinks he deserves a show on the air. I said, based upon what? Why do you deserve a show on the air? Well, what's your background? What have you done to deserve that? And, well, I fought for, you know, to take back the station. Well, you take it back from whom? Who had the station? Your people were in power before. They're in power now. Now, what's different? Same group still has it. And the only good manager in the history of the station, the only guy that demanded standards and was pro-union, isn't it interesting that the first thing that happened when the group came in, they union bashed and fired the Pacifica National News and
That's
said that it, and then
and
put
now,
a scab
you know,
labor
funny
in his
is
place.
That they can't have free speech radio news, cannot act publicly as the national news program, although we know that's what they really want. And because they have an 18-month period. And I've seen so many emails and letters by high officials at Pacifica go back and forth where they're telling each other, oh, don't be quiet, don't talk about it. We can't talk about that they're going to be our national news until the 18 months go by, you know. And I'm saying, you know, this is pro-union people.
Well, when you start cutting into the union, if people don't know that you're union bashing, then they should know, and they can support that or they can challenge it. Either way.
I would like to open up the phones very, very soon because
okay, within
time
five
is going.
Minutes. Okay. Sure, within
and
5 minutes.
Just let me, on the union issue, say this one thing, that I'm not just talking out of my hat here. I have a National Labor Relations Board along with Marjorie Moore. We had a complaint for unfair labor practices against Pacifica, and the National Labor Relations Board, as of last I've heard, has fully accepted and supported our complaint. And now Pacifica is facing, and Leslie, I think, mentioned it during the last meeting last weekend, that, in fact, now Pacifica has to deal with negotiating with us.
Okay, but the whole idea is that when will the purges stop? When will this agenda be understood? Most people listening to the radio do not know what's going on. Unless you listen to all the radio and you get a different perspective, you don't always know that people can be given misinformation or accurate information depending upon the show, depending upon the diligence, the person sharing the information. But I'm very concerned that at no point in the evolution of Pacifica was it meant to be that the labs would run the station either in programming or in the selection of the management. They were there as advisors, and that's fine. But then again, how do you know that the people on the labs represent the majority of the people listening in the audience?
It's ridiculous. Gary, I can just, they had a meeting of the WBAI lab the other night, last night, and I was reading the notes on that meeting, and I can say there's a big fight over that exact issue because the current members of the LABs don't want to go up for election, really. They want to be grandfathered into the new LABs. I mean, what the hell's the use of, pardon my French there, but what's the use of this big fight if now through democratic process the people who led the fight don't get seats on the LABs. I mean, they're not going to stand for that. So there goes democracy thrown out the window right there.
Explain briefly, and then we're going to open it up for calls and comments, questions, or challenges. Give us an understanding from your point of view of what happened with the Amy Goodman contract that people were not aware of.
Well, you know, the contract, first of all, you know, her lawyer, Michael Ratner, who's, you know, the whole Ratner family is tied in so closely with this dissident movement, and with BAI for many years, this faction, we've been talking about that, one of the cliques there at BAI for many years. First of all, you have to understand that the Ratner family is a very wealthy family. They're a land-owning family. They're much more corporate than anybody on the board, as you described earlier. But they have a left-wing history, and they're involved with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and they're very close to Amy. And the contract has Michael Ratner, who's Amy Goodman's attorney, personal attorney, as the person written into the contract as the arbitrator of any issue that arises between Pacifica and Amy in this contract. So basically, if there's any, the binding arbitration, the arbitrator, the person who makes the decision as binding to both parties according to the contract that was signed, is one of the parties' own lawyer. I find that the most shocking thing in the whole contract. Now, the second most shocking thing is that in a network that has, you know, millions of dollars in debt, that has no reserves, that can't afford a national program, that hasn't done in a year added one new program to any station, as far as I know, much less a national program.
Peace Watch.
Is now going to spend, $500,000 a year on a program that, you know, with over 500, as you said yourself, Gary, there's over 500 producers at all the Pacifica stations, and one of them is going to get $500,000 a year, and the other 500 and some odd get nothing?
Well,
yet they're raising the money to pay that?
The idea was that we should have either all of us who are on the air and producing programs should be paid proportionate to the time that we're on the air, to the stations, and one pool gives everyone. That way, everyone is virtually equal to anyone else who's on the air. If you're on the air at 3 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, one day a week or 5 days a week, at least everybody would get something, which I believe would show that we're being dealt with fairly. But historically, if they didn't care for you, you didn't get anything, even if you were bringing them money. So my audience brings in an enormous amount of the money that then is paid as a percentage that is paid as long as, well, some others like Armand DeMille and Hugh Hamilton paid nothing to pay
for
people.
They're bringing in the whole audience. I mean, literally, you know, the three programmers you just mentioned are bringing in two-thirds of the audience at WBAI.
And the money, and yet we get nothing, not even a phone bill. So there's just been this rampant discrimination that at some point must be addressed, but has been refused to be addressed. And it, unless people know that there is a problem and that politics are this steeped, and I have nothing against Amy Goodman. I mean, what she does, but I don't like the idea that this kind of contract exists. Because it's a very bad precedent.
You know, let me be critical of. I mean, I think that there's not just Amy, but there's certain, you know, within all the different programming at Pacifica, there seems to be this idea that radical news gathering a la Pacifica has to be like this ambush style of journalism, which is, you know, a common term. That means that basically, like Michael Moore in Columbine or his movie Roger and Me, you just follow around an important decision maker and you scream insulting epithets at them, and then film them and laugh at it or laugh at it afterwards. And where is the information there? I mean, I would much rather see an interview with a powerful person. I would much rather, in Bowling for Columbine, have seen Michael Moore have a real heart-to-heart conversation with Charlton Heston. You know, that would have been interesting to me, more interesting than him just insulting the guy on film and then laughing about it afterwards.
I'd like to open up the phones.
Okay. We're going to open up the phones now and invite people to share their points of view or questions.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi. I'm calling from Ohio, listening on the Internet. And, you know, I've been listening to Pacifica stations, all of them, actually, on the Internet for several years. I've been active with the Pacifica struggle. In fact, I participated with the Pacifica campaign that you've just spent close to 2 hours maligning. Now, why would somebody from Ohio participate with a national campaign to take back a network when we don't even have an outlet here in Ohio? It's because I'm very concerned about what Pacifica represents, the contribution that it makes to society and its potential for helping to change it. And you, sir, both of you, are doing the Los Angeles listeners a great, great disservice. Now, I know you'll want to interrupt me here, as is your habit, but you're spreading some real awful distortions.